Well, hi there, folks. Fred Reno here, and welcome back to the Fine Wine Confidential podcast. In this episode, number 29, I had the opportunity to interview Sharon Horton and her daughter, Shannon. Dennis and Sharon Horton have made a significant contribution to Virginia wine growing, but sadly, Dennis passed away in June of 2018, so I never had the occasion to meet him. However, both Sharon and Shannon have some very insightful, interesting stories and comments about Horton Vineyards from the early beginnings of planting a hobby vineyard at their home in the early 1980s up to today's wines and the future looking forward. I know you will enjoy this interview. One note, the audio might sound a bit muddy at times as this interview was conducted with all three of us wearing masks. Take a listen. Sharon and Shannon, this is an absolute pleasure for me to meet you and have the opportunity to document the story and history of Horton Vineyards. So thank you for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
Well, I'll start in the beginning, as I always do. What's your story? I mean, let me ask you, Sharon, why did you and Dennis, what was in your mind when you moved from Missouri to come to Virginia? What prompted that move?
Actually, we came down here. He had a business in Northern Virginia at the time.
Okay.
We wanted to move to the country. We both liked the country atmosphere. And some of his sales to the government were so prolific, I guess, that he had money left over that he wanted to start a different business. He was crazy, of course. And he loved wine. And then he started a lot of, research and studying what types of grapes he thought would grow well in Virginia and present themselves well as a wine. He was not a Chardonnay fan at all. He wanted to try something, a white wine that a red wine drinker would love. So he picked the Viognier grape, which was very, very rare at the time, hardly any planting in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We started out here with 14 acres. Everybody thought we were kind of crazy. Even Tony Wolfe and Jim Law, we had a tasting of different Viogniers, the French Viogniers at the time, and one from California. And they said, how are you ever going to sell this? Well, his major was in marketing, and he says, I'll sell it if we can grow it.
Okay.
So he did the research, figured that the climate here in Virginia was very similar to where it's planted in France. We took a trip to California and visited several different wineries out there that were also growing the Viognier at the time, talked to the different vineyard managers and owners, and then that's whenever it got started.
So you started commercially farming, or at least planted a vineyard in 1989, is that accurate?
The spring of 1990.
Okay.
We started with the posts and the layout in the fall of 89.
And then you strike lightning with the 1993 vintage, and your Viognier blows everybody's mind by how quality it is.
Blew their mind away, didn't it? Yes.
I'm just curious. Do you still have bottles of that in your cellar?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Wow. What a wonderful treasure.
Yeah, there's one on display at the winery, the 1982, which was okay. The first vintage. There's one on display with all the medals that we still have record of in a museum box with the Nikon camera. Because the original labels of the wines, the Cab Franc, the Malbec, the Viognier, yeah, and Vidal, were all the very first harvest that they came in. Dad took pictures on his Nikon, and those pictures became the labels. So when you're looking at the label, a lot of people say, it's kind of a dated label. And I'm like, yeah, but there's history behind it.
Thank you.
That's the first commercially grown Viognier in the state. And so in the museum box is like all the medals, the original bottle, Dad's signature on it, and the Nikon camera.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That is great. So you started with 14 acres here?
Yes.
Originally?
Yes.
How did you find this site, by the way? I mean, what was it about this site?
We wanted some land that would be comparable to the grapes with a bit of elevation. It's not as great here as you would think, but it's 600 feet at the top here, and everything slopes down.
Right.
He didn't want to buy the property. He wanted to lease it. So we do not own this. 53 acres here. We still lease it.
Oh,
yes. My God.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Been here 30 years.
Yes. We had a 25-year lease with 5-year options after that. First option to buy if the lady wants to ever sell the property.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome.
So I have to ask you, Sharon, how does a nurse become a vineyard manager? I
mean, very easily. Those plants don't talk back to me.
Okay.
They may talk back to me in some kind of diseases, but then I can get on top of that.
So then Dennis decides he wants to pioneer and bring back Norton.
Yes. Great.
What was the thought process there?
Well, we were both from the state of Missouri.
Okay.
We got our cuttings from
Stonehill.
Stonehill, yes.
Oh, so you did get them from Stonehill. Okay.
Yes.
And wildly successful, clearly.
Well, I would think so. It's native of here, right?
Well, yeah. I'm curious about that. So what's the difference in the vineyard of farming Norton versus your classic Viognier or Vinifera?
A lot less management. It doesn't take as much herbicides or fungicides, per se. We have it on the GDC, which is, looks like a clothesline, a T on a post. We train it down to brag a little bit. This last harvest, I got the most tonnage I ever got off of Norton. I got 7.5 tons per acre.
Wow.
Which is phenomenal. Yes.
Which equates to 75 tons.
Yes.
Just to do the math.
We
She's got 10
acres.
Acres
of Norton.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
Yes. 75 tons of Norton.
So we did, you know, the winery was a little upset.
We were not. We're running out of space.
I think you are going to preserve it delicately.
Yeah. Find another tank.
We would never be able to do this again.
No.
So.
What led Dennis on his quest to just continue to, and yourself, to plant different varietals and different varietals? You're successful with Viognier, and as I understand it, you bottled the first commercial bottling of Cabernet Franc?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got three wonderful wines.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just stay focused on that?
Oh, no. He always had to plan something and do something different and always be ahead of the game. We have put in a lot of plants that we've had to rip out, and that didn't work here. Try this one, try that one, try this one.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
And Shannon, so you grew up with this. What was this like?
It was just, that's just what it was. I mean, it was just normal. Like, it was just, that's just what we did. We worked on wine, and Mom had the vineyard, and Dad had his things, and it's just, you know, it was just part of the family.
I'm assuming that Dennis and you, Sharon, had some consultant who came in initially in the winery. Where did Dennis learn to make wine?
A book.
From books, Janice Robinson's books, yeah. All kinds of books on viticulture, and we did attend all of Tony Wolf's classes that he gave, you know.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
It's self-taught.
Yeah.
OJT.
It's all, there was no consultant.
Yes.
It was him, and it was his ideas and what he had read and
yes.
A few things that he had done in the basement.
Yes.
Like little batches from his little hobby vineyard that he was starting out with, and there were some years things didn't work, but before, he did a lot of experimenting, and he read a lot. He read that Janice Robinson wrote, the Encyclopedia of Wine. He read it. It's like a dictionary or encyclopedia, but he read it like it was a book and has notes in the margins and everything.
That is remarkable.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah.
Given the success that you've had and where you've come from, I mean, this is classic self-made, old-world winemaking.
Yes.
It goes back to what used to be.
And he asked lots of questions when you guys traveled to France. And he asked the winemakers, and he asked, the winery owners, like, how have you been making it for 20 years or 30 years?
Well, he must have had a really good recall, a really good memory.
Yes.
Yes, he did.
You know, like almost photographic memory kind
yes.
of thing.
Yes, I think so.
Yes.
Yes.
Do you, I'm curious, in the video today, do you work with hybrids as well?
Well, I would say Vidal.
So you have Vidal?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have you worked with any of the other hybrids
no.
in the past?
No. There are some very nice ones out there that are grown in Virginia that we just don't have room for.
Understood.
We have 53 acres here, 7.5 acres in front of our house in Madison County, and 6 acres in front of the winery.
The hobby vineyard you planted was planted purposely to see if certain things would grow.
Yes. Mostly all the stuff that you see on the shed side. We have one or two rows of this, one or two rows of this. Then we expanded. He tried the Nebbiolo. We expanded to 0.6 acres at our house because he liked how that grew. Tanat, we experimented with that first. Mm-hmm. Now we have the Tobler's Creek clone and Syrah. But Syrah is not really a good grape for Virginia.
Well, and then came Pinotage as the substitute.
That smoky flavor.
Mm-hmm. Why does Syrah not do that well in Virginia?
It's the winters. They're cold. Yeah. The trunks all split open one winter. The sap was coming up earlier in the year. And then all of a sudden you get a boom, a burst of cold nights, two or three in a row. Okay. Boom, there went all our plants on the shed side. But that didn't make him quit. He had to plant some more Syrah down there. and he wanted to blend it with the Mourvèdre.
Yeah, he wanted to make... And he had Grenache for a while, so he had a GDC, or GSM.
GSM.
So he had the Grenache Syrah Mourvèdre, which was our Côtes d'Orange, which is modeled after the Côtes de Rhône. Yeah. So, because we're in Orange County, so it's a Côtes d'Orange.
That's terrific. Well, he was obviously a marketing genius, too.
He was. Yes. Very much so.
So I have to ask you about climate change. You've been farming now for well over 30 years.
Correct.
What have you seen in your vineyards, if anything? What changes have you seen and what's the differences?
This past summer was very, very, very hot and dry. So I don't know if we are going towards, I've always said there isn't anything like climate change, but you might have to think about it. I think. In the agriculture. You know,
and the winter was a little bit more mild.
And the winters are getting milder.
So are you seeing earlier bud break?
Yes. We're seeing a lot more
insects
because they're overwintering before it'd be cold enough that they would die off.
So this forces a bit more spray and things in the vineyard early on or not?
Yes.
Okay.
And more vigilance.
But something like Norton really handles that pretty well.
I think so, yes.
Dad always said it was a no-brainer. It was born here. It knew how to grow here. You needed to plant it. That was his philosophy.
Well, I had a bottle of your 18 Norton on Sunday, and I drank the rest of it last night as well. I thought 18 was supposed to be a disastrous vintage for red wine in Virginia, but that wine was quite good.
Norton didn't care.
It doesn't care, usually.
So, Shannon, your role here at the company, what have you been doing and when did you start in that role?
I guess maybe 5-6 years ago. I lose track. Mom and I became more involved in the cellar aspect. Mom was always in the vineyard, but kind of left the winemaker and the winemaking to their own instructions. And because we had had a winemaker that had been with us for so long. But then I got a lot more involved in 2016, 2017. Started getting into the cellar a little bit more. Started with sparkling wines and some of the white wines because then you can get the product on the shelf and you got the results a lot quicker. If you got a 2016, you might still be in the barrel, you know, 2 years later. So, because we barrel age our stuff for quite a while. So I, you know, people always ask me, what do you do? And I'm like, whatever my mother tells me, however I can help, you know, like.
I think you're your own boss too.
Sometimes. I guess you would call me general manager, winemaker, whatever. But it was 2016. I started to do little parts to take on little things. And then my role's just kind of expanded.
Blending is her forte.
Okay.
She knows what barrels to put with what. It is phenomenal. She has a very good palate. She takes it after her father.
Yeah. Used to drive, it drove some of the winemakers crazy. I'd be like, no, you need that third barrel back in the corner. Go get that one. I need 5% of this, 2% of that.
Yes.
They're like, really? Really? I'm like, yeah. And then they put it together. They go, yeah, that's exactly what we needed.
You know, so they became used to it and they understood, hey, I better listen.
Right.
There's something going on here I may not know.
I don't know if they want to admit that, but...
But yeah, a lot of times I'll just be trying stuff in the cellar just to see what's left and what's out there. And I'm like, hey, let's just make a blend and let's put this together and this will be great. And then they're like, but you don't have a label. Okay, well, we'll find an old one. So like in the last 2 years, there's 3 or 4 labels that were retired we hadn't used in 20 years.
Okay.
And then I made new blends with and then I reintroduced the label again.
What's overall winery production at this point?
I don't know, somewhere around 30,000 cases.
Is that all estate or do you buy any grapes at all?
We were buying some Chardonnay because Dad didn't plant.
You have no Chardonnay here at all.
Well, she's got like, what, four plants?
Well, a few plants, yeah. That came by mistake.
Yeah, we ordered one thing and Chardonnay came instead.
I gotcha.
So we were buying some Chardonnay, but now I've got a good supply that for a couple of years we won't need that. And we were buying some Petit Verdot and sometimes some Norton. We were supplementing our crop. And I was also experimenting with bringing back a wine that hadn't been around for about 20 years. A Norton port that Dad had. And so that takes 4 or 5 years in the making. So I needed a little bit extra than what we were getting in. Because our supply, our demand for Norton is kind of high every year.
Well, given his curiosity and his drive originally by Rhone Wines, obviously with Viognier, that leads me to ask a question. Have you ever done any co-ferment with a little Viognier in the Norton?
No, not the Viognier with the Norton, but we have done Viognier with Syrah. We've done that co-fermentation. This year, we even did some Norton skins with Cab Franc.
But no white wine?
No, not this time.
I mean, classic Côte Rôtie can have up to 5% Viognier, right? And tends to drive the aromatics in the wine.
Yes.
And I would just be curious to, so what's your experimentation like when you do Norton with Syrah or do Norton with Cabernet Franc?
The Norton with the Cabernet Franc, I found a bottle in the cellar not too long ago. The Dad had done 75% Norton, 25% Cab Franc, or the other way around. I think vice versa. And they do well together. The earthiness with the Norton and then the aromatics and the fruit forwardness of the Cab Franc and then the peppery finish with it, that black pepper finish, is really kind of a great synergistic relationship.
Did you, you mentioned Tony Wolf earlier. Did you get help initially from the extension services out here, or did they just sort of like, what are you doing?
No, they were very helpful and they had a lot of meetings here. You know, they'd bring other wineries and have the meetings here because we had so many, I think, different varieties for people to be able to see. We have kept in touch with the extension agent, you know, very, very much so. They have experiments going on out here all the time with different types of bugs and stuff and see the leaf roll virus. They're working on that.
So I'm wondering, I'm going to butcher this name, but how'd you get your hands on some Racascelli?
Arcazzatelli.
Yeah.
What was that?
Say the Arcazzatelli.
Arcazzatelli.
You're supposed to roll the R, but I don't. I took Latin, not Russian, so
okay.
I'm not good with that. So that little pocket of land in front of the winery is literally in a pocket between like a couple of mountain ranges, and it's only 6 acres. So to put some sort of heating system, I mean, like fans or whatever, through there is not worth.
The neighbors were. Right. Said no. They wouldn't even let us put up bird alarms.
Then always.
You know, because it's in such an area, residential. So I didn't consider that. It's considered agriculture, but their houses are close.
Yeah.
We had Viognier planted out there.
Yeah.
Then we got the winter of 92.
Okay.
It was minus 22 out there. Three-year-old Viogniers didn't like it. They were just split open. So we took it all out, and Dad said, well, if we're going to put something in, we're going to put something in that's going to last. So he researched this. Our Arcazzatelli was grown in the Georgia region. Of course, he said, it's cold enough there. We should be able to survive here.
Right.
So he called Dr. Frank, right?
Yeah, he Constantine Frank.
And got our cuttings from him.
So he had some long ago. That's fantastic. Well, the wines I've had, most recently from Blenheim, because he bought the fruit from you, was fantastic. And I understand you just did a little.
Yes.
Sort of retrospective.
Yeah,
here.
Where were you?
I came to that. It was really awesome.
I did want to go to it, but I was preoccupied, I must tell you, with a project I was involved in. So the weekends had me in my office. But I really did. I saw that and went, wow, that's going to be interesting.
It was very interesting.
How many
yes.
producers were here?
Christy was there, and Rachel from Stinchin, because she buys fruit from us, and then us, and then Megan Frank was on
Zoom call from Zoom Constantine call. Frank's place.
Yes, and we had two of her wines to taste.
Okay. Right.
Everybody brought their wines, and then the Georgian Embassy brought about four different ways.
Oh, that's...
They leave it on the skins and the stems, some of their, one of their types. Yes.
That must have been dark.
Yeah. It was a bit dark, yes. Yeah. But anyway, it was very, very interesting, and they were so nice to us. You know, the people.
They gave you a gift.
Oh, yes.
They get a model Quirvy, the clay vessel.
On, you'll get to see it at the winery.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
So we have that set up. We're going to get a plaque that says it was a gift from the Georgian Embassy. Yes.
That's terrific.
Yes.
So your daughter, Shannon, is the winemaker now?
Caitlin, yes.
Caitlin? How does she jump into that?
because
nobody
she
else
was drafted,
to.
Right?
Yeah, one of those voluntold.
Yeah,
she's always had an interest in the winemaking, and she'd been in the cellar a couple of times years ago. It just happened that way, and our winemaker needed to leave for other issues. And so we were like, well, instead of trying to find one this close to harvest, because that was May, we'll just put Caitlin in. So, uh-huh. 26 years old, 400 tons of fruit, very first harvest. Here you go. Have fun.
So, she did well.
And I went over to help and then did the night shift kind of to help her. It was almost 20-hour days for like 60 days straight. I mean, it was...
Well,
intense.
Switching to the subject of distribution, what type of distribution do you have outside of the state of Virginia?
Basically, for outside the state of Virginia, we do bulk. If a winery calls us and says they need bulk wine because they've run out of wine or they didn't have a good crop, we've sold fruit outside the state, but we've also sold bulk wine outside the state. For bottle sales, it's mostly directly to customers through our online site. We can ship to 38 states. We use a platform system that obtains the licenses for us and then just takes a percentage of it. We have 38 states that we can distribute to someone's door directly to the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are in a store that does take us, that has, they're in a chain and they go forth with it. So you can find some of our wines. I know I was in California and went to a store and bought some wine. My own.
That's true. But
Dad used to be very prevalent beyond the Mississippi, and we are looking to try and get that back.
Well, given the early acclaim you had for the Viognier, I would think that there would be quite a demand for that.
We do get calls from restaurants and that kind of thing for the demand, but it's trying to get it back into the distributors. Once you lose that shelf space and once you lose that, it is very hard. And the distributor that we had in California was no longer in business, and then it didn't get pursued to find a replacement.
So I'm assuming, Sharon, that the ripping out and experimenting with different varietals has stopped.
It sort of has. There's someone pushing for Saperavi.
For what?
Saperavi. It is the bookend to Arcatzitelli. It's a Georgian.
Oh.
Georgian red, and it's big, and it's earthy, and it's spicy, and got a huge mid palate, and it's just delectable, and I would love to see that in Virginia. I know that there's one other winery that already planted it over in...
Caitlin said two of them.
Okay, yeah, because Oxeye's got it, and I think Monte Falco's got it. They both got Saperavi. Well, Oxeye's got it because they're right on the same plane as the Finger Lakes. Like their elevation. Yeah. So they need to plant things that are very similar. Did a lot of patterns of.
Megan Frank has it in.
Yeah.
She loves
it. I love her Saperavi, and I just love what it does. And I would like to put some here.
I'm going to have to research it. That's the first time I've ever heard of that grape myself personally.
Yeah. It's just phenomenal.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So favorite question I always like to ask, a very simple one. And you said earlier in the interview, Sharon, that Dennis loved wine. I'm assuming you did as well. What was that one bottle that you may have had independently or together that the light bulb went off and said, oh, now I get it. Now I understand how ethereal and interesting wine could be. Is there one wine you could remember early on?
Probably the Viognier. It would be.
So it would have been from France?
Yes.
So it's either going to be...
What's a down the cellar yet?
Oh, the con... What?
Condru. So you're either going to have Georges Vernet, who saved Condru, basically, with, or you're going to have, if you're lucky, okay, Chateau Gruyère.
I think that's the one.
Oh, my God. Okay, it's Chateau Gruyère. It doesn't get any more interesting than that. I mean, do you realize that's the one winery that has its own appellation? It's the smallest appellation in the world. Chateau Gruyère. So Chateau Gruyère.
Dad didn't mess around.
Okay? He did not, clearly.
He did not mess around. He didn't just go for whatever. He read a lot and figured out who were the ones that were the crux of things, and then he went and got their wine.
Well, I mean, now I get it. Chateau Gruyère, I get it.
And I think, like, when he went to California, he met with Mondavi.
Talked to all the right people, and he figured out for himself what the answer was for your situation.
Virginia. Yes, he did.
Because he had been drinking some Virginia wines and thinking, scratching his head and saying,
is this what
we
got?
We got to do better, you know.
Well, I will tell you, in my estimation, based on, and of course, I haven't tasted, you know, there's reputedly 300 wineries or so in Virginia. Yeah. Obviously, I haven't tasted them all. I'm trying my best. At the end of the day, from what I've tasted, my belief is a good 10 to 15%, could be a little higher, of the wineries now in Virginia produce as good a quality of wine as anybody in the world. From a qualitative standpoint. Obviously, the varietals are different.
Yes.
We're talking about different varietals here today at Horton. But the pure quality is equal to the best in the world. Now, I do reserve the term great for that 0.1% of all wine made in the world.
Right.
But then after that, then you have a high level of quality being produced around the world. And Virginia is absolutely right there today. And it continues to surprise me that wine lovers at large, both trade and consumer, aren't aware of it.
No, they aren't.
No.
And that's what I'm trying to do is change that awareness. Get people to pay attention. I mean, to me, it's the most exciting wine growing region in the country today.
That was a bottle of wine that we had right after Dad passed away that I found in the cellar from 1989.
Oh, my God.
And that's a Vognier.
Yeah, and it's a Catcher selection. Domaine, okay.
It actually was quite good. It had some butterscotch notes to it because it's of the age, but it was
1988.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
and then look at the color. It's not even that dark.
No.
Like, I mean, I thought it was going to be poop, and I was like, this is really good.
You even told the winery that you enjoyed it. Yes, and they were surprised that it lasted that long.
I sent the pictures and sent it back to the winery and said, hey, we just had this today, like in 2018, so just wanted you to know it still tastes good.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It is.
Yeah. So, I mean, that'll tell you something about that grape. Like, how many white wines do you know? I know that the winemaker needs to make it that way, and it depends on chemistry, but how many white wines can last that long and not turn into, like, a sherry or get oxidized or, you know, just turn on you? So it's a big testament to the grape itself and definitely about what Dad was getting after, that it was a red drinker's white because of the complexity of it and what it has going on.
Because of your efforts and what you did, the Virginia Wine Board declared Viognier the signature grape of Virginia back in 2011.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable.
It was a big surprise.
Yes.
Yeah. Quite a big surprise.
Dad was part of the Viognier Guild out here on the East Coast, which then merged with the Rome Rangers.
Oh.
So.
Yes.
Yeah. He was the East Coast Rome Ranger. Ranger. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty remarkable.
And then he got connected with a lot of experimenters and some people that were very much kindred spirits out in California, like Randall Graham with Bonnie Doon, who I started my own friendship with back in 2017.
Well, it looks like he's just signed himself into an interesting project.
Yes. Well, he'd been working on creating those grapes for a while in the dry farming thing and not requiring the water and what he could do and what he could experiment with. And so.
Well, they're going to need to learn how to dry farm in California because there is no water.
There is no water.
That's why he was going after what grapes he could. And I had a sip of that wine that he made that first came out of that field back in 2018 at the Smithsonian because the Smithsonian's honored the Rhone Rangers and Rhone grapes in Virginia. We were asked to be a part of that dinner and I got to try that and I was like, Randall, where do I get this? He goes, nowhere. It's not on the market. I'm like, that's not fair. You can't, like, give us treats and then not let us have any.
Oh, my God. Oh, that would be like Randall.
Yeah. It was amazing wine that he did after some of those grapes. I can't remember what the name of it is now.
Sharon and Shannon, this has been a real delight, I'm telling you. Thank you. We're here, folks, and she's right in the middle of harvest here making wine and pressing grapes. I just busted into the vineyard farmhouse here. This is like California in the 80s. I remember the farmhouses in the vineyard in California in right. the 80s when I was going out there as a buyer from Washington, D.C. in retail at that time. And this, you get that feeling. It's really great. But thank you again for your time.
Mm-hmm.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, folks, after listening to that episode, I think you can now understand why Dennis and Sharon Horton were among the critical early pioneers for modern-day quality wine growing here in the Old Dominion. Their contribution has been a game-changer at times. And speaking of game-changer, my upcoming new episode, number 30, features John Winner, the owner of Chatham Vineyards at Church Creek, located on the eastern shore of Virginia. Surprisingly, although there are other vineyards, Chatham Creek is the only winery in the Eastern Shore AVA today. I found that puzzling, but John answers the reasons for that, among others. I will tell you the wine that they produce, branded with the moniker Steel Chardonnay, is profound and one of the most exciting wines I've had since moving to Virginia several years ago. Stay tuned for this episode. As always, thanks for being a listener. And if you have any questions or comments, direct them to me at fred@finewineconfidential.com. See you on the other side. Music at Fine Wine Confidential podcast by Jason Shaw at audionautics.com from his copyrighted song, Acoustic Shuffle, under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License. I hope you enjoyed the show.